Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington. Ahead, we'll hear about victims of today's hospital bombings in Syria. Former U.S. Ambassador to Syria, Edward Juranian, speaks with us about the fragile situation in that nation. An author talks about the philosophy of science. And singer Martina McBride takes the fight against cancer on the road.
Each concert is going to have special on-site activities so that attendees can also find ways to be a more active part of the Band Against Cancer movement.
It's right here on The Voice of America. Airstrikes today in northwestern Syria destroyed a hospital supported by Doctors Without Borders, killing at least seven people, according to the group. Correspondent Jamie Detmer visited a hospital in Kilis, where some of the injured have been taken, and he joins us on the line. Hi, Jamie.
Thanks for having me on. In fact, it's not just one hospital that was hit today. There were four, two in Idlib province, two in Aleppo province. One hospital was a pediatric hospital just over the border from Kilis, Ebezaz, which had been struck before. And some of the injured from that hospital were being brought over, as well as the injured from a school that had been sheltering displaced Syrians elsewhere in northern Aleppo countryside as well. And we're not too sure about the numbers of dead in that one, because a lot of people are buried in rubble and there's no one really available to be able to dig them out. Outside the hospital at Kilis, there were a lot of crowds. Syrian refugees were already here. Some were relatives of the wounded who were being brought across. We counted 36 going into the hospital. We know that three of those died. And outside the hospital, there's a lot of anger amongst particularly the relatives and other Syrian refugees who feel that we have had these strikes a few days after there's talk of a cessation of hostilities, but the airstrikes by the regime, people believe these airstrikes were carried out by the regime, just continue and the deaths mount up.
What did they tell you personally?
One man, Mustafa, I talked to, who had been wounded on the right side of his torso and his shoulder. There was blood seeping through his bandages when he talked to me. Two of his sisters were being operated on. They'd been wounded in a strike near the school in northern Aleppo countryside, the school housing. And they'd heard an explosion, the impact of a missile outside their home. The family, nine of them, had gone out to inspect, which had been, as he said later on, a mistake, because they then they were hit by another explosion. One of the family members, a 45-year-old, he says, was killed. And then the rest of the family were all wounded.
Is there a feeling that there's just no place to run and hide?
Yes, I think that's precisely what's happening. To try to escape, to try to flee, to try to find safety. And wherever they turn, there's conflict. You have so many groups now fighting. You've got the regime airstrikes. Of course, you've got coalition airstrikes in the IS territory areas as well. You've got the YPG, the Kurds, fighting against the rebels. You've got the rebels fighting against the regime, the rebels fighting against the Islamic State. So it's very, very difficult for these displaced people to try to become refugees and leave Syria and get into Turkey, because they're trying to dodge these airstrikes, they're trying to dodge these micro-conflicts they're going through, and a landscape that they describe more like a Mad Max movie. And even when they make the border to try to get across, they've still got the risk of being shot by Turkish border guards as they try to enter illegally, because, as you know, most of the border is now closed by Turks. It has been for a year. They're letting very few refugees in. We know that there are at least 30,000 right by the border gate near Kilis, but but the numbers are higher.
Well, thank you very much, Jamie, for speaking with us today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today, and joining me with the details is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew, as always. Nice to have you.
Good to be here. Thank you very much. Well, the social media world is still reacting to the shocking death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, found dead, apparently of natural causes, over the weekend at age 79. And as many things that are inherently political, like the Supreme Court, you're seeing these two sides divided on social media. On one side, you have people saying, let President Obama appoint a replacement. It's in the Constitution. He needs to appoint someone. On the other side, you have a lot of Republicans saying, let's wait and let the next president hoping that the next president will be a Republican, will pick someone conservative like Scalia. But the thing that I really appreciate on social media is the stories that people are telling about Justice Scalia. And one of those is the fact that Justice Scalia and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg were very good friends. In fact, she put out a statement that said, "I lost one of my best friends." And people are noting that friendship and saying if Antonin Scalia, who is probably was the most conservative member of this court, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's arguably the most liberal, if they can get along together, that's a model for politics across the board. People should be able to bridge their divides and their differences. So a lot of memories being shared about him.
I just saw an interview with another friend of his, and he was saying how disrespectful it is for the Republicans and the Democrats to be fighting over whether Obama should nominate a new person when Scalia just passed away a few days ago.
Unfortunately, that's the way it is in, I think, Washington. People are always looking to the next thing and the next person and the next political fight. And certainly no lack of that on social media, as we've said. But these stories, I think, and the remembrances of him are one way to kind of delay that and look at this man that died in both sides of the aisle, too. People noting also, I think David Axelrod, one of President Obama's advisors, said that Justice Scalia actually pushed for Elena Kagan to be nominated to the Supreme Court, who is another more liberal justice. So people saying, even though this guy may have been a strict constitutionalist and conservative, maybe look at the person and not just the politics.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of scientists was able to find hundreds of nearby galaxies that had been hidden by the dust and stars of the Milky Way. This gave them some new insight into a mysterious astronomical anomaly some 150 million light years away. Writing in a new study, the group says a third of the 883 galaxies they found behind our home galaxy have never been seen before. The study's lead author, Lister Stavely Smith, from the University of Western Australia, said that while the Milky Way itself is very beautiful and interesting, it completely blocks out the view of the more distant galaxies behind it. The scientists say their discovery may also help explain a phenomena called the Great Attractor, which is described as a region of space that seems to be pulling ours and hundreds of thousands of other galaxies toward it with a gravitational force that's tens of thousands of times more powerful than that of the entire Milky Way. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
President Barack Obama has discussed the Syria crisis with Russian President Vladimir Putin, emphasizing the importance of Moscow playing a constructive role by ceasing its air campaign against moderate opposition forces in Syria. The two leaders spoke by phone Saturday to discuss the decisions and agreements made at the February 11th meeting of the International Syria Support Group and to stress the importance of rapidly implementing humanitarian access to besieged areas of Syria, a White House statement said Sunday. The Obama-Putin discussion came just days after U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov announced a plan for a cessation of hostilities in Syria within a week, with a formal ceasefire to follow at a later date. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy discussed with former U.S. Ambassador to Syria, Edward Djerejian, the fragile situation in Syria and its impact on the Geneva talks.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Friday major powers have agreed to seek a cessation of hostilities in Syria to begin in 1 week's time. How would that impact the prospects of Geneva III proximity talks on February 25th?
If indeed a full ceasefire is implemented, then that will enhance the very difficult prospects for an agreement at Geneva. But let's be realistic about Geneva III. There are very different political agendas on the table when you look at who's at the table, especially the United States, Gulf states, Saudi Arabia. You look at the position of Russia and the Iranians. There are very different political objectives, especially in terms of the position toward Bashar al-Assad's regime. So the prospects for real movement forward in Geneva are, I would just give 50-50. They're not brilliant. Unless the international community and the Gulf states realize that an all-out effort has to be made to stop the bleeding in Syria, and I use those words carefully because it's a humanitarian disaster and tragedy, and that they can come to some sort of consensus toward establishing a bona fide ceasefire and then working out a political transition process in Syria, then nothing is going to be accomplished.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Syria Robert Ford said the most important thing is to somehow pressure the Russians and the Syrian government to stop the aerial bombardment. However, he said the U.S. had not shown any willingness to genuinely pressure Russia. Do you agree with that assessment?
The Russians have an advantage because they're taking action on the ground and in the air. And what the forces, the international community supporting the Syrian opposition, the military actions that are being taken on behalf of the Syrian opposition are really minimal compared to what the Russians and the Iranians are doing in Syria. So, you know, is this just word or is it a diplomacy that's backed with a strategic and military depth? And I think that's the question.
To that effect, Saudi Arabia offered ground forces to Syria if the coalition decided to go that route. However, Russian Prime Minister has cautioned the world powers about committing their troops to any ground action in Syria. What do you make of that?
Well, I think any ground action by Saudi Arabia, Gulf states, or third parties in the region should be really a decision that is made collectively in terms of the coalition fighting ISIS in order to avoid expanding the conflict in Syria to involve regional forces. I think any ground troops should be very carefully coordinated with the United States, the Europeans, the regional powers, and there has to be a strategic dialogue with Russia so that we don't get into a conflict situation here where, you know, through miscalculations, you know, we get into a more serious military situation in and around Syria.
Final question. What would make or break Geneva 3?
Well, a couple of things can break it. One, continued Russian air activity and assertive Iranian activity on the ground. The Syrian regime continuing to barrel bomb and attack civilians under the guise that they're terrorists. That can undermine it. So if there isn't an effective ceasefire, Geneva 3 will go nowhere. The second thing is that if there isn't any progress made in Geneva 3 toward a political consensus on what a political transition should begin to look like and be, and beginning talks between the opposition forces and the regime, representatives of the regime, Geneva 3 will go nowhere.
Ambassador Edward Gerezian, thank you very much for a very informative interview as usual.
You're very welcome.
Coming up on International Edition, a look at a basic approach to science. And a country music singer is in the fight against cancer. Scientists are on a voyage of discovery, but to set out on that trip, it's best to have some foundation for your thinking. That is where understanding the philosophy of science can help. There is a new book out called The Meaning of Science, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science. And its author, Tim Lewins, joins us on the line from Cambridge. Welcome, Tim.
Hi, it's a great pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. Perhaps in layman's terms, you might explain to us, what is the philosophy of science?
Okay, so the philosophy of science is a subject with a very long history. People have been thinking in broad and deep ways about the sciences ever since the ancient Greeks, but the philosophy of science deals with a whole bunch of conceptual issues around science. Questions like, how do we tell the difference between real bona fide science and pseudoscience? Questions like, are there good reasons to think that the sciences really tell us the fundamental truth about the universe, or do they instead just give us some useful set of tools for calculating likely predictions that we might make about the observable world? A whole bunch of questions like that.
Well, how can we use this understanding?
Okay, so I think that the philosophy of science has quite a lot of fairly profound practical implications. So, for example, it makes a big difference as to, you know, the way in which you think about, for example, the scientific standing of homeopathy or the scientific standing of intelligent design theory makes a big difference to the kinds of things that our taxes should be spent on, and a big difference to the things that our kids should be taught in school. And that immediately raises a series of philosophical questions. How are we going to tell whether or not these scientific views are real science or not, or whether they're instead some kind of pseudoscience. I also think the philosophy of science is useful when we come to ask questions about the role of bias and objectivity in science. And that turns out to be very important when we think about the ways in which scientific advice is put to work in formulating policy, for example. So I think there are a whole bunch of ways in which, at the same time as offering a fairly abstract theoretical set of questions, the philosophy of science also has some real practical impact.
Could you give us some examples of where it could be used in the political and government sectors of our society?
Yeah, so it's often the case, for example, that when governments seek advice on new technologies. That might be anything from new reproductive technologies to new technologies for exploiting energy resources. It's often the case that they'll call on scientists to provide what's often thought to be a completely objective, entirely value-free assessment of whether or not it's right to go ahead with the new technological direction in question. And I think there are quite a lot of reasons to be skeptical of the idea that at least when scientists are involved in providing policy advice of that kind, there are reasons to be skeptical of the idea that they can really provide an analysis that's entirely free of values. And I think there are a whole bunch of reasons to be skeptical of that idea. One is that science is always uncertain. Scientists never know for sure what the future holds. They never know their theories for sure, just with various degrees of probability. And so that means that there's always a question, have we got enough evidence to go ahead with the technology in question?
And the name of your book again?
The name of my book is The Meaning of Science, and it's an introduction to the philosophy of science.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you very much for your time.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Philanthropy has always been an integral part of country music, and when it comes to cancer awareness, Martina McBride has been front and center. The iconic singer has recently announced an exciting new venture to empower families in their fight against this devastating disease. Nikki Strong of VOA Music joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to discuss details.
Nikki, tell us about this new initiative called Band Against Cancer.
Okay, so Band Against Cancer is a partnership with some heavy hitters, with Sarah Cannon, the Global Cancer Institute of Hospital Corporation of America, and the record label Big Label Machine Group, which has an incredible roster of artists, including Taylor Swift, Reba McEntire, Florida Georgia Line, Tim McGraw, Martina McBride, to name a few. So Martina McBride, along with several other high-profile country artists, no word yet as to who it will be, they will hit the road for the Sarah Cannon Tour. Details are still forthcoming, but right now we do know the tour will hit several cities across the U.S. and end in October, which is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Now, not only will these concerts help raise money for charitable organizations, cancer support organizations, but each concert is going to have special on-site activities so that attendees can also find ways to be a more active part of the Band Against Cancer movement, aside from just, you know, paying to go see a concert. And the objective, they say, is to bring together survivors and patients and families and friends and artists and music lovers and cancer experts and advocates in communities across the country in this fight against cancer. And through these various collective efforts, patients will ultimately access high-quality treatment and research options that are close to home where they are.
Mm. Well, will this initiative cover all kinds of cancer?
Well, the initiative initially will focus on those who will be fighting blood cancer, and then eventually will highlight other kinds of cancer as well.
Now, Martina had a huge song that was about fighting cancer.
Yes, yes, which is so appropriate why she's headlining this. The song is called I'm Gonna Love You Through It. It came out in 2011 off of her CD 11, and it's about a 38-year-old woman who is supported by her husband while battling breast cancer. It was nominated for a Grammy that year. It peaked at number 4 on the country singles chart, and it has really been a major anthem in the cancer fighting community. And Martina has participated in all kinds of events to raise awareness about this disease. So, and she says helping families who are facing cancer has always been a cause that is near and dear to her heart.
You can get more information about this initiative at bandagainstcancer.org. You can also hear Martina McBride and other great country artists on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. If you're on social media, feel free to connect with Nikki at VOA Music on Facebook and VOA _music on Twitter. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
She dropped the phone and burst into tears. The doctor just confirmed her fears. Her husband held it in and held her tight. Cancer don't discriminate or care if you're just 38 with 3 kids who need you in their lives. He said, I know that
we would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. And if you'd like to hear today's show again, visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner and scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
I'll hold on, and when you need to cry, I swear that I'll be there to dry your eyes when you feel lost.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Today is President's Day in the United States, when Americans pause to honor their national leaders, beginning with the first president, George Washington. From the time of his death in 1799, his birthday, February 22nd, was marked unofficially. It formally became a national holiday in 1885. Over time, Americans also began honoring another great leader, Abraham Lincoln, whose February 12th birthday falls near Washington's. Official recognition of the two began in 1971, with a day honoring all presidents every year on the third Monday of the month. Washington won lasting fame for leading Americans to victory in the War for Independence from Britain. His popularity was such that he could have made himself a king if he'd so chosen. Some of the officers in his army, impatient with the democratic process, urged him to do just that. "Banish these thoughts from your mind," Washington said, and issued a stern reprimand to those who made the suggestion. He ordered the army disbanded, resigned his commission as commander-in-chief, and retired to private life. At the time, America was a loose confederation of 13 states. Over the next 6 years, Americans struggled to devise an effective federal government, but one that left important powers to the states. Many Americans distrusted the idea of a central government and feared abuses of power by federal officials, especially the president. At this critical time, Washington was the one person who most Americans were willing to trust. He was the unopposed choice to be the nation's first president. When he took office, the United States had a constitution, but its government was not yet organized. When he stepped down, the U.S. was recognized by the world's major powers. Washington put the nation on a sound financial footing and created an effective military to protect America's expanding frontiers. In revolutionary France, democratic ideals gave way to turmoil, terror, and repression. But in the United States, under Washington's leadership, revolution produced stable, democratic, and lawful government. By leaving office voluntarily after 2 4-year terms, he set an important precedent for all future presidents. He also oversaw a peaceful transfer of power from one elected leader to another, a principle vital to democracy and an example for peoples around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.